Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
You are unmuted.
Good to see you, court is in session.
All right, so counsel, we have a juror that needs to leave at 3:45, so we're going till 3:45 today. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
All rise for the court, please. Jurors entering. Back in session, you may be seated.
So, jurors, we are going to stop today at 3:45. All right, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, there's another housekeeping before Mr. Brennan gets started. Group. The admission of Trooper Pete. It's going to be Trooper Dash and Mr. Brennan that I've been talking
about. All right. So, okay, great.
Thank you.
All right, do we have the actual? Okay, great. Yep. So.
Exhibit 216.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Brennan.
Good afternoon, Dr. Wolf.
Good afternoon.
When you testified in direct, you shared with the jury some of the work that ARCA does. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And you had mentioned a couple interesting things, that there had been some work with the Department of Defense?
Correct, yes.
The work with the Department of Defense, was that during your time or before you got there?
That would have been prior to my employment, yes.
So when you were telling them about working with the Department of Defense, that really had nothing to do with you, that was ARCA before you began working there?
ARCA as a whole, yes, the work that we do, yes.
Not you?
As I said, I wasn't involved specifically in that project, no.
And you mentioned that you did some stuff, or the company does some things for the NHL?
Yes.
You didn't tell us much more about what you do. There's other things that ARCA does as far as clients, right?
Certainly.
Did you share with us that you work for lawyers and law firms?
Yes, we do.
And you do litigation, insurance companies?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any reason why you highlighted the Department of Defense that you don't do, and the NHL, but didn't share the rest of the stuff with us?
That's just some of the prominent clients that we have.
I see. You provided us a CV, didn't you?
Yes.
And that's like a resume, tells us a little bit about your education experience. You get to highlight some of the things, your accomplishments.
Yes.
You shared with us you've been the director of accident reconstruction at this company, ARCA, since 2017.
No, not since I started.
You started with ARCA in 2017?
Correct, yes.
When did you become the director of accident reconstruction?
I think that would have been in January of 2024, so about a year and a half.
About a year and a half ago?
Yes.
And you received your certification from ACTAR?
Yes.
Did you pass the test on both parts first time?
I don't recall if it... I had to retake, I think, the practical section in the afternoon.
Well, you would recall something like that, wouldn't you? Did you pass both parts on the first try?
Like I said, I think it was the second part I had to retake.
Well, this is a pretty important test, isn't it?
Not really.
It's your certification.
It is, but much of the concepts that are covered in it are very elementary.
Well, not so elementary. You had a hard time with part of it, didn't you?
Well, with respect to the portion that I had to retake, it's a practical exam where you have to reconstruct an accident, you have to determine approach angles, departure angles, and it can be very sensitive to those inputs. And unfortunately, if you mess up one of your first angles and you carry out that calculation, then the whole problem is graded wrong, even if you did all of the math correct.
So we understand there's a multiple choice question part that's the easier part, correct?
I don't know that it's easier, but there is a multiple part, multiple choice part.
There's a more practical part where you actually have to go out in the field and do assessments, kind of like the things that you did today.
You don't go out into the field, no.
When did you first take that second part that you did the test?
I don't recall.
You don't remember when you took the test?
No, I don't.
Suffice to say, you took it again.
Correct.
And ultimately, you passed both sections of that test?
Yes.
In your CV, you list your schooling, and you list your degrees, don't you?
Yes.
You mentioned some of the things that you focused on in your academic experience, don't you?
Yes.
And you have publications.
Correct.
Recently, you did a publication regarding vehicle control history on Toyotas.
Correct.
Vehicle control history is data that is stored in a vehicle?
Yes.
And Toyota owns Lexus, correct?
Correct.
So you have familiarity with vehicle control history. In fact, you have a publication on it.
Yes.
In your entire resume, you only mention pedestrian collisions or that you're involved in pedestrian type events three times. Is there anything specific in your resume or your publications that show a published accomplishment, for example, in pedestrian collisions? Do you have any publications that have been peer-reviewed or published in that area?
No, I don't have any publications in pedestrians.
You write or you note areas of specialty and you list a bunch: accident reconstruction, human factors, EDR, commercial vehicle, HVEDR, pedestrian bicycle accidents, nighttime visibility, and a number of others, correct?
Correct.
Is there anywhere in your resume that notes particular classes that you've attended and completed regarding pedestrian collisions?
No, I haven't taken any classes in that.
You haven't taken any classes on pedestrian collisions?
No.
Have you ever taught regarding pedestrian collisions?
No.
Have you ever been a speaker in a presentation about pedestrian collisions?
Yes.
Okay. Is that listed in your resume?
I don't list lectures or presentations, no.
You were asked questions about your involvement in this case. Yes?
Yes.
And you had shared with us that you, at the beginning, were working for a separate party or a third party, you said?
Yes, another agency.
Another agency. And at some point, you came into court and testified last year?
Yes.
And during the time before you came in to testify, you weren't wholly independent of the defense, were you?
Well, certainly before all of our testing, at the point at which we did all of our testing, report, and analysis, as I mentioned on direct, I didn't know the Commonwealth or the defense in this case.
My question more precisely, before you testified, before you came into court and gave your testimony, you weren't totally independent from the defense, were you?
No, I mean, I had to communicate with them to be able to determine when to appear for testimony.
So you were communicating with them, yes?
Yes.
And in fact, some of the time that you spent, ARCA actually built the defense for, and they paid that bill, didn't they?
Eventually after the trial, yes.
During that time, you know what a sequestration order is, don't you?
Yes.
Do you think that they're under a sequestration order today?
Yes.
Did you talk to anybody about any of the prior testimony in this case before today?
No.
How'd you get here today?
How did I get here today? I took a car ride over from the hotel.
Who drove you?
It was a driver. I don't know his name.
Who set up the car?
It was, would have been someone on the defense team.
Was it like a window, like a limo?
It was an SUV.
Was there anybody from the defense with you on the ride over?
There were three young ladies in the back seat. I think they might have been interns, and Mr. Woke.
And who?
Mr. Woke, I think is it pronounced? Am I saying it wrong?
Have you discussed anything about this case before your testimony today as far as the trial?
before today?
Yes.
Yes.
Have you discussed anybody's testimony in this case?
Nobody's testimony, no.
That was different last year, though, because before you testified last year, you did have discussions about testimony, didn't you?
Not with the Commonwealth or the defense, no.
But I'm asking, though, you did have discussions about testimony before you testified last year, right?
Correct, yes.
And you know what a sequestration order is, don't you?
Yes.
After you testified last year, the court ordered you to provide all of your text messages, all your communications with the defense, didn't they?
Yes, earlier this year.
And when you were ordered to provide all of the actual verbatim communications with the defense, did you provide those communications?
Yes, all of the records that I had at the time I provided.
Well, not the records, you know what I'm getting at. Did you provide the communications?
I provided everything I had in my possession, sir.
A text message isn't just a time and date, it's actually substance when you text somebody, isn't there?
Correct.
And when you texted, how many texts do you think you had with the defense?
From what I recall, I think it was around 50 texts that I sent.
It wasn't 100, I think it was 50?
Well, I think it was around 100 total in terms of back and forth, but it was, I think, 50 that I sent.
And during those texts, communications, conversations, correct?
About logistics, yes.
Did you provide the content of those text messages when you were ordered to by the court?
Well, those text messages spanned from, I guess it would have been April or so of 2024 through May to June of 2024. Ultimately, I think I received the court's order in May of this year, April of this year. So it was a year after the fact, and I had already deleted the text at that point.
How many of those text messages did you delete?
I just swiped the conversation, so it would have been the whole conversation.
Not how you did it. How many of those 100 or so text messages did you delete, sir?
It would have been the whole text chain. I didn't individually delete them. It just, when you swipe, it just deletes the text chain.
After you deleted them, did you go into the recently deleted and then delete them so they were unavailable?
I don't recall doing that.
Well, you were asked to search your records for the text messages. Did you do a thorough search to see if you still had them or whether you had destroyed them all?
I checked my phone and I also checked with my phone carrier.
So do you know if they were still under the recently deleted part of your phone, or did you go and take that extra step and totally destroy them?
From what I recall, I did not find any of the text messages, no.
Is there any reason why you deleted all of your text communications with the defense?
Well, it's something that I routinely do. I work with attorneys and clients all the time, whether it's appearing for trial or inspections, and I don't have a habit of keeping a text chain that talks about logistics and things. It's just I routinely delete them after that communication is over with, and certainly after the prior proceeding, once it had concluded, there was no reason for me to preserve those.
Okay. And so, at some point, you switched from text messages to another form of communication, didn't you?
Yes, earlier this year.
Tell us a little bit about this new form of communication, not text messages.
So, Mr. Jackson had indicated that he and his defense team utilized an application known as Signal for their communications amongst their defense team. Ultimately asked if I would also use that application to communicate, which I agreed to.
Is Signal an encrypted app?
It's a secure encrypted app, yes.
It doesn't leave any records, right?
I don't believe so, no.
Well, you have it. You're using it. Do you have any records from your Signal use?
Judge, I'm going to allow that.
Do you have any records from your Signal use?
I do not, no.
So you know full well that Signal is an encrypted app, leaves no record.
There may be a setting that you can change. I just know that the way that it was set up, there was no record.
Well, who set yours up to have no record?
I don't know. I think it was default.
Have you ever checked your Signal app to see if you have any record of your communications pursuant to that court order?
Well, I don't have the application anymore, but at the time I did check the application.
Out of all these clients that you've had, how many times or how many clients would you use Signal with?
This was the first time.
Have you used it since with other clients?
Not yet, no.
Before you testified last time at the last proceeding, or should I say when you testified at the last proceeding, kind of like today, you attempted to portray yourself as totally independent, didn't you?
Objection. Sustaining that point.
When you testified at the prior proceeding, did you attempt to portray yourself as totally independent?
Yes.
The truth is, before you testified, you were communicating with the defense and attempting the best you could to assist their cause, weren't you?
I wouldn't characterize it that way.
So before you testified, you wrote out questions that you thought could help, that you should be asked when you testified, correct?
So something I routinely do before testifying is prepare an outline of topics and questions that would best help be able to get out my opinions and the analysis I undertook, ultimately so that you all have an understanding of what I did.
So I'm asking you a question. You gave the explanation, but you're skipping over the answer to my question. So I'll ask you again. Before you testified, did you write out a list of questions that you wanted to be asked?
Yes.
And when you listed out the questions, you also listed out the answers, didn't you?
A general response. It wouldn't be verbatim to that.
I didn't say verbatim, because you list out the answers to each and every one of the questions that you had prepared.
Yes.
So for every question, there's an answer that you provided so that you could follow a script, so to speak, yes?
I wouldn't characterize it as a script.
One of the questions asks, so not being able to inspect vehicles is something that is not uncommon in your line of work? And your answer, absolutely not. Remember writing that out?
Yes.
And you put a footnote, a comment. And you said, not sure if you want to put this somewhere in the direct examination. I have a feeling they are going to argue I didn't personally inspect the vehicles. I had enough information from the material I reviewed, so it wasn't necessary. Need to show the jury it doesn't matter in this case. Did you write that?
Yes.
When you're talking about they, I have a feeling they are going to argue I didn't personally inspect the vehicle. Who's they?
That'd be the Commonwealth.
And so when you were writing out these questions, as is your routine, with the answers, is this the mark of independence to you?
Well, I think, again, whether the Commonwealth asked me that question or the defense asked me that question, my response would be the same. It wouldn't change depending on who called me to testify. There are a number of cases. By the time I get involved, the evidence is gone from the roadway, the vehicle is gone. So it's certainly not necessary to inspect a vehicle. And I wanted the jury to have an understanding that because I didn't physically inspect the vehicle, it didn't affect my analysis in the case.
So you think that showed independence?
Yes.
Then you also had another question. Would it be fair to say that because you do a lot of nighttime visibility work, your cases frequently involve pedestrians? Remember that?
Yes.
And you said, yes, unfortunately, there is a direct correlation between time of day and pedestrian fatalities. Is that true?
Correct, yes.
And do they happen more often in the day or at night?
More often at night, yes.
Statistically speaking, by the way, this case involves nighttime, doesn't it?
Correct.
Statistically speaking, most of pedestrian fatalities occur during the evening and night hours. So my specialty in the area of lighting and human factors results in a lot of my cases involving pedestrians. Did you write that?
Yes.
In fact, when you testified, you shared that with the jury, didn't you?
Correct. I've testified to that twice last year as well as this year.
And in the notes that you wrote, when you shared it last year and this year, was it an important point for the jury?
I think so, because it helped gave them an understanding, I think, of my background and lighting and human factors. And as I mentioned earlier today, there's a direct correlation between time of day and pedestrian impacts, right? So my specialty in lighting and human factors results in me seeing many, many different types of pedestrian impacts.
So if it's important, why did you include a note If you don't want me to say this, that's fine. Why did you include a note to the defense that if they didn't want you to say something that you thought was important, you would leave it out?
Well, I think because I didn't want to confuse the jury about a statistic that just because we have inclement weather and dark lighting conditions, it doesn't automatically equal a pedestrian impact, right? We have to look at the evidence and the damage to the vehicle and the injuries to determine whether or not a collision occurred, not the visibility.
So you weren't trying to mislead the jury, you were trying to help them because they wouldn't understand something that you were trying to explain? Is that the way you're phrasing this?
I think at the end of the day, it was to help them understand my background, how it relates to seeing a lot of pedestrian impacts.
Something was important that helps the jury get to the truth. Why would you offer to leave it out?
Well, I didn't leave it out.
No, but you offered to. You would have if requested. Why did you invite, why did you invite somebody else to interject in your independence and guide you to leave something out? Why would you even provide that invitation to them?
Again, it's because I didn't want them to get hung up on a statistic that just because we have more pedestrian impacts at night and in bad weather, that this alleged incident happened at night under bad weather, to give it more weight, to weight the evidence more because of that statistic.
You done?
Yes.
If you make a mistake in court under oath, would you take the affirmative step on your own and correct that mistake?
Objection. I'll allow it.
I would do my best to do that, yes.
Well, when you say do your best, would you do that if you became aware of it?
Objection.
I'm going to allow it.
Yes.
Before you testified in a proceeding last year, there was a hearing that you testified in front of Her Honor and other people that were here, correct?
Correct.
I wasn't here.
No.
You were.
Yes.
And you testified about your experience, didn't you?
Correct, yes.
When you were sharing your experience with the court, it was important for the court to have an accurate understanding of what your experience was because it was being evaluated in that hearing, wasn't it?
Correct.
When you testified to the court, you testified that you had been qualified as an expert to testify over 20 times, didn't you?
I don't have the transcript. I believe I said approximately 20 times.
The reality is you hadn't. You'd only testified and qualified 11 times at that point.
Correct. I misunderstood the question. I thought it also encompassed deposition, so I added those two and approximated at 20.
And at some point when you realized you had made a mistake in your testimony to the court, you had a chance to come back when you testified last year and fix it and clarify the record, didn't you?
Correct, which is why I provided a comment with the specific breakdown for clarification.
And when you came back and testified under oath the second time, on the record, under oath, did you clarify and fix the mistaken testimony that you had provided just days earlier?
I don't recall being asked a question, no.
It wasn't whether you're being asked. The question is, did you take the affirmative step to fix the misstatements under oath that you made?
Objection.
Sure. After your first testimony, you appreciated that you made a statement under oath that was wrong, didn't you?
Yes.
In fact, you made a note. I realized in my testimony I said about 20 times when you asked how many times I had been qualified. I misinterpreted your question, which was my fault, but in looking at my D&T list, it's 11 trials, 7 depositions, 18 testimonies total. Not sure if you want to clear it up or just leave it.
Correct. Correct? Yes, sir.
Did you just leave it?
I'm not responsible for asking the question, sir.
Do you ever heard the terms confirmation bias?
Yes.
Do you know what confirmation bias is generally?
Generally, yes.
Do you think that you suffer from any confirmation bias in this case?
No.
Do you have any close family that supports one side over the other? Not the facts or the data, but one side over the other.
Close family?
Yes.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Wife?
My wife?
Yes.
I don't really know what her thoughts are on the case.
May I approach?
Yes.
Have you looked at that document? Have you seen that before?
No, I have not.
Never seen that?
No.
Bring it back.
You're unaware of anything that may influence you to lean one way or another?
Correct.
When you first took a look at some of the facts in this case, you had some information. Since then, you've received a lot more, haven't you?
Correct, yes.
Part of your testimony today to this jury was to provide opinions that you do not think that the holes in Mr. O'Keefe's clothes are consistent with some type of collision. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
In coming to that opinion, you relied on some of your testing that we saw in those videos, didn't you?
Yes.
And that testing involves a hybrid three-arm, doesn't it?
Correct, yes.
A hybrid three-arm is an arm from a crash dummy.
Yes.
That's not the technical name, but that's what it's often referred to.
Yes.
And you and Dr. Renshaw have been working together on this case, haven't you?
Yes.
You've discussed ideas and shared thoughts.
Yes.
In fact, you've worked so intimately together, you know some of the things he's going to testify if he comes to testify, you've said many times today, right?
Yes.
And so some of the data that you shared and some of the opinions overlap with each other, wouldn't you say?
Certainly, he's going to rely on a lot of that test data, yes.
When you were forming your opinion about holes in clothes and potential abrasions to somebody's skin, all of those tests, all of those that you did, were using a crash test dummy arm, weren't they?
Yes.
In your report, you cite, or Dr. Renshaw cites, three different sources regarding testing clothing and skin, correct?
I'm not sure.
Well, haven't you read his report?
I've skimmed it, but I don't know what the basis are for his opinions.
Did you see footnotes 24, 25, 26, 24 being skin tissue cutability and its relation to lacerations, severity, indices? Did you read that?
Let's see if there's a foundation.
No, I didn't read that reference.
Did you read 25, the book that is cited, Forensic Pathology, second edition?
I'm going to have you come to sidebar.
Let me again ask you about this book that is cited in Dr. Renshaw's report. By the way, have you read Dr. Renshaw's report?
As I mentioned, I skimmed through it.
So in all of your preparation with Dr. Renshaw, you merely skimmed through his report? You didn't take time to read and study it?
Well, none of my opinions are based on work that he did. He's undertaking a completely separate aspect in the analysis.
But that's not the question. The question I asked you was, did you, in working closely with him, take the time to study his report?
As I mentioned, I skimmed it. I didn't read through, as you mentioned, all the references or what he cited. I didn't do that.
Did you read his report?
I did read the report, yes, but I didn't in depth go through each reference and look at what he was citing.
So you read his report?
Yes.
And when you read his report, did you see there were footnotes for a number of different propositions that he made?
I know that there were footnotes in the report, yes.
Well, on the issue of whether or not crash test dummies should be used during experiments as a basis for an opinion of whether abrasions can happen through cloth or an arm. Wouldn't that particularly interest you since you were going to come here and testify about it multiple times in front of this jury?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You knew you were going to come in here and suggest to the jury that you thought that these tests were inconsistent with causing any type of holes in clothing similar to Mr. O'Keefe's or abrasions on his arm. You knew that was going to be part of your opinion today, yes?
Yes, yes.
As part of forming a valid opinion that people can rely upon, wouldn't you want to do as much study as possible on the background for that opinion before you give it to a jury?
I suppose, yes.
Well, you suppose. Don't you think if you come in here as an expert, the jury is relying on your background and education?
Yes.
And they're relying on the fact that you're representing something definitively or with an opinion to a reasonable degree of certainty? You understand that, right?
Yes.
And don't you think when you do that, that it's important that you have proper study and foundation before you just come into court and give an opinion?
Well, I will note that the ATD crash dummy is a generally accepted test device to use for not only assessing occupant forces in motor vehicle crashes, but also to assess impact forces. So that the use of that device is certainly generally accepted.
When you get uncomfortable with my question, you generally tend to answer a different question.
Sustain, Mr. Brennan, next question.
Oh, that's a strike.
Strike that, Jules.
Let me ask you again. Don't you think, as an expert, it's important when you come in and you're going to present an opinion based on science or engineering or whatever you want to do, that you study the basis for that opinion before you give it?
Yes.
When you saw in Dr. Rentzel's report references to this very issue about what should be used when you're doing demonstrations or study of what can cause tears to clothing, weren't you interested in the basis for those opinions?
Well, again, it was something where Dr. Rentschler and I worked together, and we were in agreement that we could utilize the ATD arm clothed.
When you decided to have an agreement that you could use that arm, did you read the book that he cites as support, Forensic Pathology, Second Edition, Vincent J. DeMaio? Did you read it?
No, I did not.
Did you brief it?
No.
Did you peruse through it at all?
No.
When you decided to come to this agreement that's going to have a foundation for your opinions, did you look at footnote 26, understanding the acute skin injury mechanism caused by player surface contact during soccer, a survey and systematic review? Did you review that?
No, sir.
Have you seen any articles that support the proposition that a hybrid 3 arm of a crash test dummy is appropriate to use when you're trying to provide a foundation for an opinion about whether or not tears can happen to clothing or abrasions to skin? Do you have any support for that in your report?
Well, again, Dr. Rentschler is going to be addressing the... You're shaking your head.
So I'm going to let him answer the question first.
So as I mentioned, Dr. Rentschler is assessing the injuries to the arm, okay? He indicated to me that we could utilize the hybrid arm to assess the injuries to the arm.
So you have no independent experience or research or knowledge? Not Dr. Rentschler, you don't have any independent research or science or knowledge to support your idea, your theory, your opinion to this jury about the tears to the clothes into the skin?
I was relaying the observations from the testing that we conducted with the ATD. Ultimately, like I said, Dr. Rentschler, it's my understanding that he will testify to the abrasions or the lacerations to the arm.
You've given multiple opinions about this to this jury, didn't you?
Correct, yes.
I'll ask you one more time. Name, I'll ask it this way. Name, other than someone called Dr. Rentschler, name the papers, the studies, the learned treatise, name the resource material you relied on as the basis for those opinions.
that a hybrid free arm can be used in these type of demonstrations as a basis for that type of thing?
I certainly, ATD crash test dummies can be used for impact testing, yes.
On impact testing, you're talking about pierced to clothes, abrasions to skin, and I'm asking for the third time, name one journal, one paper, one study that supports your proposition that you're relying on as the basis of your opinion in front of this jury today. Name one.
I did not cite any in my report, no.
Can you think of one that you didn't cite?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
You had mentioned on direct examination that when you first started looking at materials some time ago, at the beginning, you were unconstrained in the scope of your study. Is that fair to say?
Are we talking about 2023?
Yes, we are.
Okay, yes.
You were unconstrained. You could have done anything you wanted to.
I don't know about anything.
When you said unconstrained, what did that mean?
Well, the agency that retained us didn't ask us to do specific work per se or specific tests.
You didn't do any type of crash test at that time, did you?
Not like was demonstrated today, no.
Instead, you started a working theory that perhaps a glass was thrown at the rear taillight of the defendant's car?
Yes.
Did someone suggest to you that was a theory?
No.
It's just something that you and Dr. Rentschler thought up together?
Based on the evidence that we had, yes.
When you thought up that as a potential theory, that's why you built the potato cannon?
The pressurized cannon, yes. Yeah,
pressurized cannon. And you shot a glass at the rear taillight, yes?
Yes.
You determined that at 37 miles per hour, there'd be similar damage?
Yes.
And then you came into court last year, didn't you?
Yes.
And you provided that opinion of consistency to the jury, didn't you?
Yes.
You got up and you said that something to the effect that that speed is consistent with the damage?
Yes.
Now, when you gave that theory last year to the jury, did you know about other evidence in this case? For example, if a glass was thrown at the back of the car, how would the bottom of the glass bounce off the car and land near Mr. O'Keefe's body?
Judge,
ask it differently.
Did you consider, when you came in last year and opined, gave your theory about a glass being thrown at the taillight is consistent with damage, did you think about how, if a glass was thrown at the rear taillight, the bottom would have bounced off the vehicle, wherever it was, and landed there, and so he'd fly?
I'm aware that it was found near his body, yes.
And knowing that it was found near his body, well, you knew his body was about 7 or 8 feet off the road, didn't you?
Yes.
Knowing the bottom of the glass, the broken glass was found near his body 7 to 8 feet off the road, did you consider if somebody threw a glass and broke that taillight, did it cross your mind how the bottom of the glass bounced with him to where his body ended up?
No, I did not analyze that part of it.
If a glass was thrown and bounced off that car, did you consider how the sneaker would be left in the curb?
No, I did not evaluate that.
If glass was thrown at the car and broke the taillight, did you consider how the debris field would end up on the lawn?
Well, it's my understanding, I think that there were plows that came through that night, so I don't know that where the debris field was eventually found, if that's where it would have been at some point earlier.
Did you ever talk to Lieutenant O'Hara or anybody from the state police to see if the plows went all the way to the side of the yards or were just down the middle? Did you look into that at all?
No, I did not.
So did you give any careful consideration to if the glass was thrown and hit the back of that taillight,
how there'd be a debris field on the front lawn of somebody's yard?
I don't think that was a part of our scope. It was more or less to determine whether or not, if the taillight was impacted by a projectile like a glass, could you get generally consistent damage to that taillight? That was the objective of the test.
So when you came in and testified last time, you weren't considering all of the other evidence that may not support that theory, were you?
I think our objective was to determine whether or not the damage was consistent with an interaction with Mr. John O'Keefe, and could there be another mechanism to cause the tail blight to break?
Is there a reason why you were backing off that opinion on direct examination today?
Objection.
Sustained.
You weren't fully embracing that theory today, were you?
Objection.
I'm going to allow that.
I don't know if I agree with that.
In this case, you provided reports recently?
Yes.
When did you provide your report? Was it April 6th?
April 6th?
Or was it May 6th?
I think it's May 7th,
May
7th. If I'm not mistaken.
So you provided a report May 7th, yes?
Correct.
And do you know when this trial started?
Early April.
You provided your PowerPoint. When did you provide your PowerPoint?
I think it would have been Thursday of this week.
Well, it wasn't last night.
Sorry, maybe Wednesday. Wednesday or Thursday.
Wednesday. Is that fair?
Yes.
In looking at pedestrian accidents, it's important to try, if you can, understand the exact positioning of the body, isn't it?
If a collision occurred, yes.
And if a collision occurred, you can't always identify the exact position of the body, can you?
No, oftentimes it can be very difficult, yes.
You would want to know, if it is a collision between a car and a pedestrian, whether the person was fully impacted or it was a clipping type incident. Wouldn't you want to know that if you could?
That would certainly affect the trajectory, yes.
And you would want to know, if you could, the body posture, whether the person was standing up straight or crouching.
If a collision occurred, yes.
Whether they were turning or standing straight or they had their arm out, that's helpful information, isn't it?
It can be, but when we're talking about how quickly this impact duration is, right? If you recall back to the PowerPoint, right, we're talking about a 10 millisecond window. So however the body is positioned at contact, that's how it's positioned. It's not going to be able to have any significant movement or change in orientation in that 10 millisecond window.
The position of the body can change the trajectory of the person who's hit, can it?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
The positioning of the body, the way they're positioned, that can change the trajectory if they're hit after they hit, can it?
It can, yes.
Whether they're moving towards a vehicle or away from it could affect the trajectory, couldn't it?
If they have some relative velocity, yeah.
Trying to determine the point of impact when you're looking at a scene, it's important when you do trajectory studies to know where the point of impact is, isn't it?
If you're going to utilize studies that look at projection of pedestrians when you're contacted at the center of gravity and you get projected some distance, you can rely on those studies, but you have to have an understanding of where the point of impact is and where the point of rest is.
If you don't have the point of impact, if you don't know the point of impact, you don't know the exact body position. That creates variables in your studies, doesn't it?
Well, for, again, talking about those studies, they're not applicable when you are contacting, for instance, just a limb, or you don't have a center of gravity hit. Those when you're talking about how far will a pedestrian get projected, if it's like a forward projection or what's known as like a wrap projection, where the pedestrian wraps onto the hood and then becomes decoupled, those studies are applicable there. But when you're talking about where there's minimal overlap between the body and the center of gravity, then you can't utilize those studies.
So you would not want to know where the point of impact is?
In this particular case, no, I don't think it would be helpful.
You would not want to know the body position?
I don't think that it would be helpful in determining Because again, we have to start with, does the damage, is it consistent with a collision?
So you would not want to know the body position. That's what you're telling us. You don't want to know that.
Well, if the evidence indicates that the contact is inconsistent, then that's kind of where the reconstruction stops. You can't go to a point of impact and a point of rest if there was no contact.
So you don't want to know the body position.
Objection.
Can you answer that?
I don't understand his question, Your Honor.
When you're doing studies, you don't want to know the body position?
Objection.
Can you answer that, Dr. Wolf?
Again, it depends on the type of impact. For the alleged contact in this case, you can't rely on those studies about impact location and point of rest. They're not applicable to this.
I'm not talking about studies. As far as data, information, you as the person doing tests, would you want to know the body positioning?
And this time we'll get an answer and that'll be it.
You got an answer every single time.
Can you answer that, Dr. Wolf?
I feel like I've answered it the best I can, Your Honor.
Okay, next question.
You don't like that question?
Objection.
Sustained. Strike. Jurors disregard.
Okay. When you were doing these video demonstrations, was it important to be as accurate as possible?
Yes.
Data changes if information changes, right?
I'm not sure I understand
your
question.
That's a tough question. You want to be precise as you can in ultimately having a conclusion regarding data, don't you?
Yes.
Could I have PowerPoint page 12, please? Now look at force on the bottom. The first letter F signifies force, correct?
Correct.
And the last two letters, MA, signifies mass. Yes?
Correct.
That's a very important part of that equation, isn't it?
Yes.
If you change the mass, it can change the whole analysis, can it?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Let me make it more simple. When you did these tests, you chose a arm from a Hybrid 3 crash dummy, didn't you?
Yes.
You can take that down, Ms. Gilman. Now, when you made that choice, you knew that John O'Keefe's arm, based on the statistics and his weight of being 216 pounds, you knew that his arm weight would be 11.8 pounds, didn't you?
Yes.
And you knew that he was 6'1" tall?
Yes.
When you decided to choose an arm in this case, you didn't choose the arm closest to his weight, did you?
It was representative enough, yes.
It was representative enough?
It was close enough, yes, sir.
Close enough. Wouldn't you want to get an arm most closely related to his actual weight?
I don't know that you can have custom-made ATDs.
But you probably can't custom-make them, but they have one that's 12 pounds. You know that, don't you?
Are you referring to the 95th percentile?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
So there's a 12-pound arm. Mr. O'Keefe's is 11.86, according to the statistics. You know that, right?
Yes.
You looked it up?
Yes.
You didn't tell us that on direct, though, did you?
I don't believe I was asked that.
No. Instead of choosing the 12-pound arm, which is 0.12 difference, you chose a much lesser weight, didn't you?
It was about 10 pounds, yes.
No, it wasn't about 10 pounds. It was less than 10 pounds. Let's be exact. You're a scientist. Let's be as precise as possible when we're talking about data. It was less than 10 pounds, wasn't it?
I think according to the spec sheet, I think it's 9.4 pounds total.
How about 9.38? You keep coming up a little bit. 9.38 pounds.
Sustained in that form.
May I approach?
Yes.
Showing you a photograph. Is that a photograph of your materials in this case?
Yes.
And in that photograph, it shows the arm that you used in your studies, doesn't it?
Correct.
And it shows that that arm weighs 9.38 pounds, doesn't it?
Yes.
And that is less than the 11.86 pounds of Mr. O'Keefe's arm, yes?
Correct, yes.
You didn't put that photograph in your PowerPoint to make it clear to everybody you were using an arm that was a much lesser weight for you.
No, I didn't put that photograph.
I can move this to evidence, please.
Okay. Any objection, Mr. Jackson?
No, you are. Thank you.
Court's permission, I'd like to show this to the jury.
Just give him some minute. Let Madam Court Reporter mark it.
Exhibit 217.
Yes, now you can play it.
This is the arm that you used in all of your videos, right?
Correct, yes.
And you can see, could you zoom in, Ms. Gilman, on the weight? 9.38 pounds.
Yes.
Right. There's a bigger difference between 9.38 and 11.86 than there is 12 and 11.86, isn't there?
Correct, yes.
So when you do the math, and have you done the math before on this? When you do the math, it's 26% difference, isn't it?
In terms of more force?
No, of mass, weight, 26% difference.
Okay.
Right?
I'm going to trust you, yeah.
Well, do you have a calculator?
I do.
Can you do it?
Sure.
Okay. And before you do that, you took this from a, you know, Mr. O'Keefe's 6'1". You used a crash test dummy that, what is the height on it?
Well, the ATD, I believe, is 5'7". The Rescue Randy, I think, is 6 feet tall.
We'll talk about the Rescue Randy later. We have questions about Randy. But let's talk about this. 5'9". You said 5'7". It's actually 5'9".
Sorry, 5'9", yes.
And it's 170 pounds?
171, I believe.
Mr. O'Keefe's not 170 pounds?
No, not his whole body.
He wasn't 5'9"?
Correct.
Okay. So when you do the math and you take the 9.38 pounds based on the 171-pound doll, and you look at the percentage, doesn't it come out to 5.48% total body weight?
Yes.
Okay. And so the difference, when you look at it, it's a 26.3% difference from his actual weight, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
And so I'm probably at the sixth grade level on this, but isn't it very basic that the more something weighs, the slower something has to go to have damage? And if something weighs less, the other part that collides and the force has to go faster?
The force is going to be greater if the mass is greater.
So if you throw a 5-pound rock into a window, you can throw it slower to cause the same damage if you have a 2-pound rock.
I don't know if I agree with that analogy.
Do you agree that based on the 26% difference, in order to actually be accurate, to be specific, to be scientific, you then have to adjust the speeds that you presented on the demonstrations, and you have to reduce the speed by 26%?
I don't agree with that.
Don't agree with that. You think that having a lighter arm, so what you're telling us is having a lighter arm would cause the exact same amount of damage to the taillight studies as a heavier arm. Is that what you're telling us?
Well, if you look at, for instance, the 29-mile-an-hour impact test, that's significantly more kinetic energy. So the momentum of a 6,000-pound vehicle moving at 24 miles an hour, 29 miles an hour, that's going to overcome whatever the mass is that it's hitting at that point.
You're sidestepping my question.
Objection.
Sustained. Ask a question, Mr. Brennan. Just ask a question, no more.
My question is, are you telling us that having a lighter arm does not impact the damage in these tests as opposed to using the heavier arm?
Certainly not in the field test, no.
And so you disagree that when you look at the weights of those arms, do you disagree there's a 26.3% difference?
Yes.
You disagree?
No, I'm sorry, what was your question?
Do you agree there was a 26.3% difference in the arm weight that you used opposed to John O'Keefe?
Yes, the hybrid arm compared to Mr. O'Keefe's arm, yes.
And you are denying that there needs to be an adjustment to your calculation because the mass, MA, is different. You're denying that.
I think, again, if you're And this is something Dr. Rentschler, I believe, will touch on.
No, I want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to Dr. Rentschler.
Well, because when you're addressing the forces for injury and the mechanisms for injury, right, you would account for the difference in the weight.
So you're saying that it makes no difference that you use an arm that is 26% lighter. Is that what you're saying to us?
No, I don't think it would have made a significant difference, especially if you look at, for instance, the if you're looking at the 95th percentile hand and the 50th percentile hand, they both weigh 1.25 pounds. They're the exact same weight. There's about a pound more roughly in the forearm and a pound more distributed in the upper arm.
But that's not my question. It's not whether it's significant or not. I'm asking you, are you saying under oath right now that a 26.3% difference had no impact on the calculations in that study? It would have no impact at all?
The calculations, yes, but in terms of the damage, no, I don't think that 1 pound difference, when we're talking about something that's 6,000 pounds striking something that's, quite frankly, whether it's 9.4 or it's 11 something, it's not, you're not going to get a difference in the damage.
So why not just have a 3 pound arm up there?
Well, I think that's unreasonable, sir.
What's that?
I think that's unreasonable.
What's the difference? It's a 6,000 pound car, according to you. What's the difference between 26% and 40%?
Well, I don't even know that I agree with your percentage, because again, you're accounting for the whole part of the arm that goes up to here, which we did not strike that part.
Mm-hmm. It's how much lighter, 2 pounds and what, how many ounces?
Sorry, what was your question?
How much lighter is it, the arm that you used?
Wait, in terms of a percentage?
No, in terms of weight, the weight, 9.38.
Right.
And Mr. O'Keefe, 11.86, right?
About 2.48.
And you're saying that makes no difference? None.
Not in the observed damage at those speeds, no.
Why didn't you use a 5 pound arm, sir?
I'm sorry, what was your question?
Why didn't you use a 5 pound arm?
Again, I don't know that they make a 5 pound ATD arm.
You didn't tell us when you did these studies, you didn't disclose in your PowerPoint that you used an arm that was much lighter than Mr. O'Keefe's arm, did you?
I don't know that it was, I didn't give the weight in the presentation, no.
Let's take a look at some of your testing. The first one was at 10 miles per hour, test A. You remember that test, right?
Yes.
Now, 10 miles per hour, if you had taken 26% off, would you agree it would change the actual speed from 10 miles per hour to 7.67 miles per hour? If you did out the math, if you did it specifically, accurately, precisely, would you agree, using the wrong arm, you make the deductions in the calculations, that that 10 mile per hour test would actually be 7.67 miles per hour. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't allow that.
No, because again, the arm is gonna get accelerated up to that speed. So the speed would still, that mass would still be accelerated up to 10 miles per hour. Same thing in the vehicle testing. It's gonna be, given that weight difference, it's gonna be accelerated up to that speed.
Now you, can we see the video of test A, please? Now this is your study, 10 miles per hour you claim, with a arm that is 9.38 pounds, correct?
Correct.
Mr. O'Keefe, 11.86 pounds, yes?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Now, this light on the end of this, you're trying to replicate the light on the back of a Lexus?
Correct.
If a Lexus at 6,000 pounds hits a person, the Lexus isn't stopping automatically, is it?
No, it would move at a common velocity with the arm.
It would continue to push forward through the arm, yes?
It may, yes.
And the arm can push into the light before the body turns, yes?
I don't know that I agree with that, no.
If the light on the Lexus, not at this speed, but if the light on a Lexus was broken, or breaks and it hits the arm, it's not going to bounce off the arm. It's going to push through, isn't it?
It's going to move at a combo velocity with the arm.
And that will move not only the arm, it will move the person's body, won't it?
It may, yes.
It may push the body, it may throw the body.
I don't know about throw.
And the light, if broken, will continue to press against the arm until the separation. Isn't that fair to say?
It could. In some instances, again, it could bounce.
It could, because it's not always the same. It's a dynamic process, isn't it?
It is dynamic,
yes. You could do the test many times and get very different results, couldn't you?
I don't know that I agree with that.
Would you get the same result every time?
I think you would certainly get similar results.
Every time?
If you had the exact same impact location and speeds, yes.
Well, that's my point. What if the impact location moved a little bit? Could it change?
Well, is Dr. Welcher changing? I don't know if, again, I was relying on what he provided in his report.
This isn't on Dr. Welcher. I'm asking you.
Objection.
No, it's not.
Okay, so jurors, disregard that exchange between counsel. Next question.
If the body position change, you may get a different result. Isn't that fair to say?
I was going after what Dr. Welcher had represented in his report analysis. So we did testing to analyze his orientation that he had demonstrated in his report.
You don't like that question either?
Objection.
Sustained.
If the body position changed, it could change the result. True?
I don't know what you mean by body position. Do you mean the whole body, the arm? What part of the body?
Okay, let's start with the arm. If the arm position changes, it could change the result, couldn't it?
Well, I'm not aware of any other orientation that Dr. Welcher provided in his analysis report as to alternative orientations.
If the arm position changed, could it change the result?
Yes, I mean, I presume if you don't have your arm on the taillight, then yes, you'll probably get a different result.
Okay. What if it's bent in a different way? Could that change the result?
Again, I haven't reviewed anything that indicates that there was a different orientation that Dr. Welcher suggested.
You're a scientist, right? You can think. I'm asking you, just a general question over here. If you bend the arm, could it change the result?
It could.
Thank you. Okay. When a person, a pedestrian is struck, they are not held stationary on a harness, are they?
No.
In this case, the crash test dummy is on a harness?
Yes, he's supported.
Strapped?
Yes.
By its hips or pelvis?
Yes.
That's not real life. That's not how a pedestrian is usually when they're hit, right? They're not strapped to a harness, are they?
No, and again, the purpose of this test was to evaluate the arm. We're not looking at the whole body here with this test.
And when we talk about injuries, part of injuries is not just the impact, it's the drag, in this case, from the car, isn't it?
It could be, yes.
But when you put the dummy on a harness, restricting or restraining its movement, it is not going to replicate hitting somebody and their movement, including the drag, is it?
I don't know that I agree with that, because it will replicate, again, when we're talking about that impact pulse of 10 milliseconds, it will replicate that. And that's ultimately what we're after, is what's happening in that 10 millisecond window in terms of the contact and the damage and the acceleration.
I know that's what you're after, but what I'm asking you is, when you end it, when the light stops, unlike a Lexus, and the dummy is stationary, unlike a person, it affects the aftermath, the drag and the push after, doesn't it?
Yes, the kinematics would be different, likely, if it's not restrained like that.
In real life, the pedestrian usually is not restrained, are they?
Correct.
In real life, a 6,000-pound Lexus, upon contact with an arm, doesn't usually stop on a dime, does it?
No.
Can I have the photo from test A, please? And so there is no break, but there is a crack in this light that was a result of this experiment where this light hits that restrained dummy, yes?
Yes.
And this is at 10 miles per hour in your world and 7.67 if you take off the 26% weight.
Projection. Sustained is to that four.
If we can move to test B, please. Now this test B, a similar test, it has the same limitations, doesn't it? This dummy is restrained at the pelvis.
Yes.
Could you show the video, please? There's two videos. We can see the first one. And was the dummy restrained by its head as well?
Yes.
Was its arm restrained in any way?
It was tethered, but it was free to move.
This test you have is 17 miles per hour with the arm that's 9.38 pounds. Mr. O'Keefe, 11.86 pound arm. If you considered that 26% difference, wouldn't it be fair to say that this test, rather than replicate 17 miles per hour, would actually replicate 12.6 miles per hour?
No, can you answer that?
Not the way it's phrased, no.
And so looking at this test, test B, which you say is 17 miles per hour, can you do a calculation for the 26% difference, or is that something that you don't think is fair?
I don't think that'd be a fair way to characterize it. Again, if no matter what the mass is there, if you're accelerating it,
yes,
at 17, that arm is going to move at 17.
If, well, not just the movement, the damage. If this arm was 5 pounds, do you think the test would have the same exact result?
If it's 5 pounds?
Yes.
Probably would be less damage.
It'd be less damage. So to get this amount of damage, you would have to increase the weight, right?
Sorry, what was your question?
To get this amount of damage, you couldn't use a 5 pound arm. There would be less damage with a 5 pound arm.
Correct.
Right, because the less weight you use, the less damage at that speed. That's
correct.
Basically how it works.
Correct.
Okay. So, in this test, if we could run that back again, you have a restrained dummy at the hips and the head. There's no follow through of the light or the body that's attached to that arm, correct? And at this speed, you can see the shards of taillight. You can see them move, can't you?
When you say move, you mean just...
Not stationary.
Yeah, I mean they're moving from the taillight, right, as they break.
Detached from the taillight.
Correct, they're broken.
That could create a debris field, yes?
Yes.
And you can see them floating in the air, some of them actually floating, and then touching the sweater. Do you see that?
Possibly. Some of it might be, again, some of that polyurethane foam.
Yeah, some might be. And why don't we play it again so we can see clearly? Some might be taillight shards too, right? That black object spinning, that's not poly foam, is it?
No, it would not be.
That'd be taillight shard, right?
Correct. Right.
And so, even at this speed, you can see, in this type of collision, there is significant, bless you, significant amount of taillight shards that are broken from the taillight and spewing into the air, yes?
Well, there, I think on the one of the slides I had, I think I showed the fragments that were left, and from what I recall, I think there was four pieces from the taillight, yeah, from the lens.
If you could put that back a little so Dr. Wolf can see it again, to the point of the collision. Even at this speed, go ahead. Stop. You can see pieces, large, small, medium, maybe even microscopic, are now breaking off from that taillight and being littered into the air, aren't they?
Yes, there are pieces coming off.
If we can go to test C, please. Now, in test C, you actually use only an arm. Isn't that fair to say?
Correct.
You don't use a body or a crash test dummy?
No.
You don't, in fact, this is not the 12-pound arm either. This is the 9.38-pound arm?
Correct.
And when you do this test, you have the arm. It's basically just an object suspended in the air, isn't it?
Yes.
And you said, I think on direct examination, I think you said that this is the same as if it was on the dummy? Is that your testimony?
Well, in terms of, again, the amount of weight that would be interacting with the taillight, whether it's attached to the dummy or not, what's in direct contact is going to be the same.
Well, the fact that it's just floating up in the sky like that, it's very different than if it was attached to a person or a dummy, isn't it?
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapist provides specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.